Good. Great. Whatever happens, I'll never say you're insensitive about food. After the carob-based low-sugar petit four and decaffeinated coffee arrived, I asked for the bill. The check, please. And Jean returned the conversation to Rosie's plans. Full-time at home with the baby. Won't you go nuts? Oh, I'll get a part-time job so that we're self-sufficient. I'm thinking about different options. I might go home for a while, to Australia. There was a contradiction in the sentence. So that we're self-sufficient, I might go home. My hope that Rosie might simply have made a grammatical error was extinguished when I realized that we must be referring to her and Bud. If we referred to Rosie and me or to Rosie, me and Bud, our aggregate self-sufficiency did not require her to have a job, nor had she consulted with me about moving back. I was stunned. The waiter brought the bill, and I automatically put my credit card on it. Rosie took a deep breath and looked at Jean, and then looked at both of us. I guess that sort of brings me to the other thing I wanted to talk about. I mean, I don't think it's any secret. You don't have many secrets living in the same house. She stopped as Jean stood up and waved at the waiter who approached our table with my credit card on a silver tray. I calculated the tip and filled it out, but Jean took the tray from me before I could sign. "What sort of tip is that?" he said. 18%, the recommended amount. Exactly, judging by the odd sense. Correct. Jean crossed out my writing and wrote something else. Rosie started to speak. I really need to say... Jean interrupted. I think we owe them a little more tonight. They've given us a pretty special and slightly crazy evening. He raised his coffee cup. I'd never seen a coffee cup used in a toast, but I copied his action. Rosie did not raise her cup. To Don, who put so much into this evening and who makes life just a little bit crazier for all of us. There was a pause. Rosie slowly lifted her cup and clinked it with Jean's and mine. No one spoke. As we left the restaurant, we were assaulted by the flashing of cameras. A pack of photographers was photographing Rosie. Then one called out, "Wrong one! Sorry, guys!" We caught a cab home and went to our separate bedrooms. Chapter 26. Jean confirmed my analysis the following evening. Rosie had been planning to end our marriage. It was only because last night at the restaurant reminded her why you two got together in the first place that she stopped short. But that's not the problem. Agreed. The problem is not my suitability as a partner, it's my suitability as a father. I'm afraid you're right. Claudia would say they're inseparable, but Rosie seems to have made the separation. Rosie was in bed. Rosie, who had encouraged me to look beyond my limitations, who was the reason for my life being more than I had ever envisioned. I was sitting with my best friend on a balcony in Manhattan, looking over the Hudson River to the lights of New Jersey. With the world's most beautiful woman and my potential child asleep inside, and I'd almost lost it. I was still at risk of losing it. "The trouble," said Jean, "is that the things that Rosie loves you for are exactly the things that make her think you're too different to be a father. She may be a risk-taker with relationships, but no woman's a risk-taker with her kids. In the end, it'll come down to persuading her you're average enough to be a father." It seemed like a sound analysis, but the solution remained the same. Work hard on fatherhood skills. Although I had made enormous progress thanks to my obstetric studies, supplemented by delivering Dave the calf and the work with the Lesbian Mothers Project, my new skills had not been visible to Rosie due to the absence of a baby to apply them to. Other initiatives, such as the pram, had had an unexpectedly negative impact. I anticipated that things would improve after the birth, but was now faced with a challenge to survive the final 14 weeks of the pregnancy without Rosie rejecting me. One inadvertent error could make the difference. Given my propensity to make such errors, it was vital that I create a buffer zone. I needed expert input to create the optimum survival plan. Dave was shocked. "You and Rosie? You're kidding me. I mean, I knew you were having some problems, but no worse than Sonia and me." "She's prioritized the baby over our relationship, which is leading to marriage failure." George laughed. "Sorry. Not laughing at you. But welcome to the real world. I wouldn't say your marriage is over just because she's behaving like every other woman. It's in their genes. Isn't it, Jean Genie?" I'm not going to win a Nobel Prize for telling you that women are programmed to focus on the baby. But I think Don does have a problem. Jean looked at me. It started when he didn't go to the sonogram. Shit, said Dave. I took time off for that, and I never take time off. You missed something, Don. I saw the hard copy of the image. I was feeling defensive. I had screwed up. It's different. We could see the baby moving around, and, I mean, after all the effort, there it was. Dave was showing signs of emotion. George pulled a bottle from under the table, and I applied my corkscrew. The baseball season was long over, and we were at Arturo's Pizza in Greenwich Village. George's extreme tipping allowed us to violate the rules and bring his ludicrously expensive Tuscan wines, which he now claimed to prefer to English ale. The break in conversation allowed some time for thinking. Jean tasted the wine. What do you think? Asked George. About the wine? Oh, only one of the 10 best bottles I've ever tasted, and I'm with 3 blokes in a pizza parlour. I shouldn't have ordered the Diavolo, but about Don and Rosie. Jean swirled his wine around in the glass, which was too small for fine wine appreciation. There's no point sugarcoating the pill with Don. Rosie doesn't think that he can cut it as a father. Think about repeating patterns. Rosie was brought up by a single parent, so maybe she sees that as her destiny as well. Jean's insight was of no practical use to me. I could not change the past. Dave had been silent, finishing the first shared pizza. I'm trying to make this refrigeration business work. It's like playing baseball, he said. All I can do is try to execute right every day and hope the results come, and that Sonia doesn't give up on me in the meantime. All Don can do is try to be the best he can and hope that Rosie comes round. Dave was right. I needed to do everything I could to be the best father I was capable of being. I'd made a start. Unknown to Rosie, I'd interacted so successfully with a baby that I'd raised its oxytocin levels. But I needed to do more. I had obtained input on the crisis from 42.8% of my friends, including my new friend George. I had distilled their messages into, there is a problem, and don't give up. I decided not to call the Eslers. I did not want them to join Rosie, Jean, George, Dave, Sonia, and Stefan, in knowing there was a problem. That left Claudia, world's best psychologist. This time she decided to use voice rather than text when I connected with her on Skype. I'd not yet worked out what determined her preference, but the speed of voice communication allowed me to explain the problem in less than an hour. Claudia delivered her analysis almost as soon as I had finished. She's looking for perfect love. She's idealized something that she's lost before. She could understand that love is never perfect. Too abstract. Her mother died when she was 10. Even if her mother's love wasn't perfect, Rosie had no chance to find out. So she went off looking for a perfect father, who didn't exist, of course, and then she found a perfect husband. I'm not perfect, I said. In your own way, you are. You believe in love more than any of us. There's no grey with you. You're suggesting I'm incapable of dealing with continuous concepts, that my mind is somehow Boolean. You're never going to cheat on Rosie, are you? Well, of course not. Why? It's not right. I realized that I was saying, unless you have an open marriage, of course. Let's not go there, Don. This is about you and Rosie. But at some point, Rosie will have discovered that you're human. You forgot an anniversary. You don't read her mind. It's unlikely I would forget a date, but mind reading is not my strongest attribute. So now she's on another quest for perfect love. Repeating patterns, I said. Where did you get that from? Don't bother answering, but it's valid in this case. And from what you're saying, she's not seeing you as part of that perfect love. Being yourself probably works beautifully with just the two of you, but not so well with a baby, in her mind. Because I'm not an average father. Perhaps, but average may not be enough. Her picture of a father is problematic. She had a lot of issues with her own father, didn't she? The problems with Phil have been resolved. They're friends. Even as I said it, I remembered Jean's observation about childhood problems. It doesn't change the past. It doesn't change her subconscious. So what do I do? That's always the hard part. I was reaching the conclusion that psychology researchers needed to give more attention to problem solving. Keep working on being a father. Maybe try to discuss the issue with Rosie, but not in the terms I've used. How can I discuss it without using the terms you've used to explain it? It would be like trying to explain genetics without mentioning DNA. You've got a point. Maybe just keep trying and let her know you're committed. There's a problem. Don't give up. And Don, I waited for Claudia to finish the sentence. I'd rather you didn't say anything to Jean, but I'm seeing someone. I'm in a relationship with a new man. So I think the time has passed for you to worry about getting Jean and me back together. The conversation appeared over, so I terminated the call. Claudia obviously had not finished. She sent me 2 text messages. Good luck, Don. You've surprised all of us so far. Then, I think you know the new man in my life. Simon Lefever, head of the Medical Research Institute. The data gathering stage of the Lesbian Mothers Project was complete, and I had reviewed the initial draft paper. At my request, B3, the helpful nurse, had sent me the raw data, and I had undertaken my own analysis. The results were fascinating and definitely a useful contribution to the field. There were numerous ways to improve the paper, and I sent my notes to B2. She did not respond, but B1 demanded a meeting with the dean, who invited me to join them. Don's demanding that we include data that was gathered before the protocols were properly in place. It's misleading. It's the most interesting data, I said. It establishes that neither mother raises the baby's oxytocin levels through play rituals. That's because the original play rituals were male-biased. The female carers weren't comfortable with them. The baby sensed this. We had to make them more appropriate to women. They would be classified as cuddling, I said. You didn't see them. You weren't there. The second part was true. Emails advising me of the schedule had failed to arrive, and the technicians I had contacted had not located the problem, despite multiple follow-ups and escalation. Fortunately, B3 had found a more efficient solution. I was provided with video. Who does it matter? Asked Dave. Don's surely entitled to see the video. He's not qualified to determine the difference between play and cuddling. Agreed, I said. I sent the videos to experts for analysis. Who did you send the videos to? The original researchers in Israel, obviously. They confirmed that the second protocol should be classified as cuddling. Hence, your research establishes that the secondary carer, if female, stimulates the production of oxytocin in the child by cuddling rather than play, which is a clear difference from the results with male secondary carers. Hence, interesting. It seemed that B1 had not understood my point as she stood up with an expression that I provisionally diagnosed as angry. I clarified. Hence, highly publishable. The researcher I spoke to on Skype was extremely interested. What Don has done is totally unethical, said B1, showing our results to other researchers. Naive, perhaps, not unethical. This is the Columbia Medical School, open and cooperative with researchers around the world. Don has our support. After B1 had left, the dean congratulated me on my persistence. They tried to cut you out, Don. I think most researchers would have walked away. Refusing to take no for an answer has given us a good result. The weather had turned cold, as was usual for early December. Bud's diagram was now taking up 4 tiles. At 29 weeks, with the medical services available in New York, he could possibly survive in the external world. Our marriage was surviving in shared house mode. Rosie had invited her study group to our apartment to celebrate the end of classes prior to exams and also her deferral from the course. It'll probably be the last time I see these guys, she said. We've got nothing much in common. Most of them are younger than me. Only by a few years. They're adults. Just. And they're not into babies and stuff. Anyway, if you and Jean want to go out with Dave. We had a boys' night out last night. Dave is being criticized for insufficient attention to Sonia and also has to perform paperwork. Jean has a date with Inga. A date. Correct. It was pointless to use a less accurate term. Jean had confessed that he was in love with Inga. George had argued that the age difference was irrelevant, and Dave had no opinion. Jean's visa allowed him to remain in the US for a month's vacation on completion of his sabbatical, and he planned to spend the time looking for a permanent position in New York. How about George? Rosie had not met George. The persistent suggestion of alternatives led to an inevitable conclusion. I had learned something from the Lesbian Mothers Project. You don't want me here. It's my study group. This is also my apartment. The study group meeting is a social occasion. I'm your partner. Are other people bringing partners? Maybe. Excellent. I'm RSVPing in the affirmative. The dean would have been impressed. Chapter 27. Jean provided me with some guidelines for hosting a party. Loud music, low lights, salty food, plenty of booze, fresh shirt and jeans, the shoes you wore for Dave the Calf, if you've cleaned them. Don't tuck your shirt in. The unshaven look is fine. Shake hands, serve food, serve drinks. Don't do anything to embarrass Rosie. What makes you think I'll embarrass her? Experience. And she told me. Not in so many words, but she tried to get me to break my date with Inga so I could take you off her hands. Fat chance. This is the big one. The big one. You plan to have sex with Inga. Believe it or not, it's been remarkably chaste so far. But my professional instincts tell me that tonight's the night. I made the party arrangements and Rosie confirmed that all was going according to plan when I arrived home. What's all this booze? She asked. I had to sign for 5 cases of liquor. We can't afford to be spending like this. Delivery was free and there was a discount for the quantity. Based on past behaviour, you'll be drinking to excess again once Bud is born. I told people to bring their own. We're just students. I'm not, I said. And Don? I'm thinking of moving back to Australia, remember? Before the baby's born, I won't be around to drink it. I'd moved my weekly discussion with my mother forward by 30 minutes to accommodate the party and make a decision to lie in order to avoid inflicting emotional pain. Has it arrived yet? My mother asked. I told the truth. It arrived on Thursday. You should have called. Your father was in a state about it. It cost a fortune to send. God knows what he spent on it already. He was talking to people in Korea. Half the night, and then the boxes arrived, and he had to sign all these documents about patents and secrecy, and of course he had to read every word. You know what your father's like. He's worked on it day and night. Trevor's had no help in the shop for weeks. I think you should speak to him. She turned away and called out, Jim, it's Donald. My father's face replaced my mother's. Is it what you wanted? He said. Excellent. Perfect. Incredible. I've tested it. Meets all requirements. This was true, too. What does Rosie think? Asked my mother in the background. Totally satisfied. She considers Dad the world's greatest inventor. This was a deception. I had not shown Rosie the crib. It was in Jean's closet. After the pram problem, I considered there was a high probability that she would reject my father's most amazing project. The first to arrive for the study group celebration was a couple, vindicating my decision to be present. Rosie introduced them. Josh, Rebecca, Don. I extended my hand, which they shook in turn. I'm Rosie's partner, I said. What would you like to drink? We brought some beer, said Josh. There's cold beer in the fridge. We can drink it while yours returns to optimum temperature. Ah, thanks, but this is English beer. I worked in London in a pub for 6 months. Got a taste for it. We have 6 real ales on tap. He laughed. You're kidding me. I showed him to the cool room and drew off a pint of Crouch Vale Brewer's Gold. Rebecca followed, and I asked if she wanted a beer or prefer a cocktail. The social protocols were familiar, and I was feeling very comfortable as I mixed her a Ward 8 and performed a few tricks with the cocktail shaker. Other guests arrived. I mixed cocktails to their specification and handed around the salted padron peppers and edamame. Rosie turned off the music I had selected and replaced it with a more current recording. The noise level remained high, lights low, alcohol consumption steady. People appeared to be having fun. Jean's formula was working. So far, there were no indications that I had embarrassed anyone. At 11:07 p.m., there was a knock. It was George. In one hand, he had a bottle of red wine, and in the other, a guitar case. Revenge, eh? Keeping an old man awake? Mind if I join you? George was our de facto landlord. It seemed inadvisable to refuse him entry. I introduced him, took his wine, and offered him a cocktail. By the time I returned with his martini, all of the guests were seated, and George had started playing and singing. Disaster. It was 1960s-style music similar to that which Rosie had turned off earlier. I assumed George's performance would be similarly unacceptable to young people. I was wrong. Before I could think of a way of silencing George, Rosie's guests were clapping and singing along. I focused on refilling drinks. While George was playing, Jean arrived home. We had an apartment full of young people, a significant percentage of whom were unaccompanied women, disinhibited by alcohol. I was worried that he might behave inappropriately, but he went directly to his bedroom. I presume his libido had been exhausted. The party finished at 2:35 a.m. One of the last to leave was a woman who had introduced herself as Mai. age approximately 24, BMI approximately 20. We spoke together in the beer fridge while I selected liquor for a final cocktail.
"You're so not like what I was expecting," she said. "To be honest, we all thought you'd be some kind of geek."
It was a notable milestone. Tonight, at least in this limited domain of social interaction, I had managed to convince a cool young person, and apparently her fellow students, even in the face of a preconception, that I was within the normal range of social competence. But I was concerned with how the preconception had arisen.
"How did you deduce that I was a geek?"
"Well, we just thought, well, you're with Rosie, the only person on the planet doing an MD and a PhD at the same time. And the way she just says what she thinks, how we've got to drag her into doing anything social, and then it's like, oh yeah, I'm having a baby, but let me get these stats done first. We thought she'd gone for someone the same, and here you are with the apartment and the cocktails and the muso buddy and the retro shirt." She sipped her cocktail. "This is awesome. Is it okay to ask, is she getting any help with the clinical thing?"
What clinical thing?"
"Sorry, I'm sticking my nose in, but we've talked about it because we want to help. She's so obviously using the pregnancy as a way out."
"Of what?"
"Her clinical year. I mean, she wants to do psych, and she'll never have to touch a patient after next year if she can get some help to get through it. I gather there was some sort of trauma in her childhood, a car accident or something that's freaked her out about emergency medicine. Rosie had been in the car when her mother was killed, and Phil badly injured. It would seem reasonable that confronting the injuries of others might stimulate traumatic memories, but she had never said anything to me. Inga asked to see me urgently on Monday morning after the party, then offered to buy me coffee.
"It's more of a personal matter," she said.
"I can see no logical reason why personal and social topics need to be discussed in a cafe and accompanied by beverages, whereas research topics can be discussed in both the work environment and in cafes. But we changed location and purchased coffee to enable the conversation to begin."
"You were right about Jean. I should have listened to you.
He attempted to seduce you."
"Worse, he says he's in love with me."
"And that emotion is not reciprocated?"
"Of course not. He's older than my father. I thought of him as a mentor, and he treated me like an equal, but I never did anything to suggest. I can't believe he got it so wrong. I can't believe I got it so wrong."
In the evening, I knocked on Rosie's door and entered. I had expected she would be performing some task at her computer, but she was lying on the mattress. There was no book visible. The lack of distractions created an ideal opportunity to raise an important topic. "Maya told me there was some problem with clinical activities, a phobia about patient contact. Is that correct?"
"Fuck. I told you, I'm dropping the medical program. The reasons don't matter."
"You said you were deferring, David Borenstein."
"Fuck David Borenstein. I'm deferring. Who knows, I may go back, I may not. Right now, I'm a bit busy with exams and having a baby."
"Obviously, if there is some obstacle preventing you from achieving a goal, you should investigate methods for overcoming it." I could empathize with Rosie and was in a position to help. I'd faced an almost identical situation when I switched my studies from computers to genetics. My revulsion at handling animals increased in proportion to the size of the animal. It was irrational but felt instinctual, hence difficult to overcome. I undertook hypnotherapy, but attributed my cure to the cat rescue incident, in which it had been necessary to save a housemaid's kitten, which had jumped into the toilet, a doubly unpleasant task. I learned that I could create an intellectual separation from the physical sensation in an emergency. Once I knew the brain configuration, I was able to reproduce it well enough to dissect mice and assist in the delivery of a calf. I was confident that I could function in a medical emergency and that I could coach Rosie to do so too. I began to explain, but she stopped me.
"Forget it, please. If I wanted to do it enough, I'd sort it out. I'm just not that interested."
"Do you want to see a play tonight?"
"What play?"
"It's a surprise."
"So you haven't bought tickets or anything? Haven't you got stuff scheduled?"
"I've scheduled a play for both of us, as a couple."
"Sorry, Don."
I saw Jean next. He was also in his room, lying on the bed. Our household was aggregately depressed.
"Don't say anything," he said.
"Inga spoke to you, right?" Jean had asked me not to speak, then asked a question that required me to answer. I decided that the latter overrode the former.
"Correct."
"Christ. How do I face her? I've been a complete idiot."
Correct. Fortunately, she's been similarly imperceptive in failing to note that your interactions with her were aimed at seduction. I recommend it's okay, Don. I don't need your advice on etiquette. Incorrect. I'm extremely experienced at dealing with embarrassment resulting from insensitivity to others. I'm an expert. I recommend an apology and admission that you're a klutz. I have recommended to her that she apologize for not making her position clear. She's similarly embarrassed. Nobody else knows except me. Thanks. Appreciate it. Do you want to go to a play? I have tickets, I said. No, I'll stay in, I think. Bad decision. You should come to the play with me, otherwise you'll reflect on the error but make zero progress. All right. What time? Don Tillman, counselor. Before leaving, I prepared a meal for Rosie and put the other two serves in the fridge for Jean and me to eat later. I had a minor problem with managing the cling wrap as a result of poor dispenser design. Rosie got up from the table and pulled out a new sheet. I can't believe you can't manage cling wrap. How would you ever fold a nappy? Can't you just be normal about some things? She turned around. Jean had joined us from his bedroom. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. Forget I said it. I just get frustrated sometimes because you have to do everything differently. No, he doesn't, said Jean. Don's not the only man who has trouble with cling wrap or can't find things in the fridge. I remember your friend Stefan back in Melbourne throwing a wobbly over someone stealing the sugar from the tea room. He went on for about 5 minutes, and by the time he'd finished, half the department was standing there, all looking at the sugar bowl right in front of him. What's Stefan got to do with anything? Said Rosie. Do you or Rosie want to do a shift? It was Jamie Paul, the following night, texting from the wine bar that used to be a cocktail bar. I texted back, has Wineman forgiven me? Who's Wineman? Hector's gone. Rosie offered to join me, but Jamie Paul had said you or Rosie, which I interpreted as per common English usage as an exclusive or. It was not quite the same as before, in part due to the absence of Rosie, but Jamie Paul informed me that former clients were returning and asking for cocktails. Wineman had been dismissed following an incident in which nobody could produce a satisfactory whiskey sour for the owner's brother. Christmas was only 15 days in the future and the bar was busy, hence the need for my services. I left Rosie and Jean to eat the dinner I'd prepared. It was a good feeling making cocktails, an incredibly good feeling. I was competent and people appreciated my competence. Nobody cared about my opinions on gay couples raising children or whether I could guess what they were feeling or if I could manipulate cling wrap. I stayed past the end of my shift, working unpaid until the bar closed, and I could walk home in the snow to an apartment made empty, in a virtual sense, by its occupants being asleep. It did not work out exactly as planned. As I was writing a note to advise Jean and Rosie not to disturb me before 9:17 a.m., Rosie's door opened. Her shape had definitely changed. I had a feeling I was unable to name, some combination of love and distress. "You're very late," she said. "We missed you, but Jean was nice. Difficult for all of us at the moment." She kissed me on the cheek to complete the set of contradictory messages. Chapter 28. I had an opportunity to compensate for failing to attend the two ultrasound examinations. The antenatal briefing was to be conducted at the hospital where Rosie had arranged for the birth to take place. I was determined to attend and perform well. The Good Father's class, where I had graduated after only one session, was the benchmark. David already attended an antenatal class. "It's mainly for the fathers," he said, "about what to expect, how to support your partner, that kind of stuff. The women know it already. The guys embarrass themselves and their wives by how little they know." I would not be an embarrassment to Rosie. "I'm only doing this because it's part of the deal," said Rosie as we rode the subway to the hospital. I was tempted not to show up just to call their bluff. What are they going to do? Not let me have my baby? Anyway, I'm probably not even going to have it here. It would be unwise to take any risk on such a crucial matter.
Yeah, but like I said before, you didn't have to come. They'd be discriminating against single mothers if they made the fathers come.
Fathers are expected to attend, I said. Fathers are provided with an understanding of what to expect in a supportive, non-threatening and fun environment.
Thanks for that, said Rosie. Non-threatening is good. Wouldn't want a karate exhibition.
Rosie's statement was completely unjustified, as she was unaware of the two occasions on which I had used martial arts in reasonable self-defense in New York. She was presumably referring to the jacket incident on our first date and confirming her recent selective memory for events that cast me in a bad light, even though she had been amused at the time and come home with me. In the foyer, there was an urn, a selection of low-quality instant beverages, including several that were caffeinated, and sweet biscuits, which were definitely not on the list of pregnancy power foods. We were 3 minutes early, but there were approximately 18 people already present. All the women were at various stages of pregnancy. I did not see anyone who appeared to be a lesbian secondary carer. A group of three introduced themselves to us. Two pregnant women and a man. The women were named Madison, estimated age 38, BMI not estimated due to pregnancy but probably low under normal conditions, and Delancey, approximately 23, BMI probably above 28 under normal conditions. I pointed out that Madison and Delancey were both New York street names. My mind was working at maximum efficiency, hence noticing interesting patterns. The man, who was the husband of Madison and aged approximately 50, BMI approximately 28, was named Bill. There's also a William Street, I said. No big surprise there, said Bill reasonably. Got a name picked out for your boy or girl yet? Not yet, said Rosie. We haven't even talked about it. Lucky you, said Bill. It's all we talk about. What about you? Rosie asked Delancey. Madison and I talk a lot, but it's a girl and it's going to be Rosa after my mom. She was a single mom too. Repeating patterns. Rosa was a similar name to Rosie. If her surname was Jarman, her name would be an anagram of Rosie Jarman. Or if it was Mentilli, it would be an anagram of Rosie Tillman, which would only be interesting if Rosie had adopted my surname when we were married. I recommend avoiding a name associated with your ethnicity, to reduce prejudice, I said. I think you might be the one bringing your prejudices with you, said Madison. This is New York, not Alabama. Bertrand and Melanathan's study of discrimination in job applications was based on research in Boston and Chicago. It would seem unwise to take the risk. Another idea popped into my head unbidden. You could call your child Wilma, a combination of William and Madison.
There's a name that's due to make a comeback, said Bill. Since prehistoric times. What do you think, Mad?
He was laughing. I was performing well, hyper well, socially.
And how do you and Madison know each other? Rosie asked Delancey.
Madison answered, Delancey's my best friend and our housekeeper. The relationship sounded very efficient. Interestingly, the first two letters of Delancey appended to the first two letters of Madison, made, which was a homophone for Delancey's role, which was an anagram of dame, which seemed to relate to Madison's role. Also, Edam, which is a cheese, and mead, which is a honey-based alcoholic drink. It would be interesting to create a meal in which all foods were paired with anagram drinks. My racing mind was interrupted by the late arrival of the convener. Before she could be distracted by educational tasks, I informed her of the catering problem in some detail. Rosie interrupted. I think she's got the message, Don.
Oh, I'm glad we have a dad who knows about nutrition in pregnancy. Most don't have a clue.
Her name was Heidi, age approximately 50, BMI 26. And she seemed very friendly. The education component commenced with introductions, followed by a video of actual births. I moved to the front row when one male student vacated his seat and left the room hurriedly. I'd already watched numerous online videos covering the most common situations and complications, but the bigger screen was a definite benefit. At the end, Heidi asked, "Any questions?" She moved to the whiteboard in the front corner. Remembering Jack the Biker's recommendation, I shut the fuck up initially to give others an opportunity. The first question was from a woman who identified herself as Maya.
In the breech presentation, wouldn't they normally do a cesarean?
That's right. In this case, I guess they don't pick it up until labor was well along and it was too late. And as we all saw, it still worked out fine. I've been told I have to have a cesarean unless the baby turns. I really wanted a natural birth.
Well, there are risk factors with a natural birth in breech position.
How risky is it?
I can't give you all the facts and numbers. Fortunately, I could. I walked to the whiteboard and, using the red and black markers, showed how the umbilical cord could be crushed in a breech birth and provided a breakdown of factors contributing to the decision to perform a cesarean section. Heidi stood beside me with her mouth open. Maya was expecting her third child, so the risk was reduced.
Your pelvic bones and vagina will already be well stretched.
Thanks for sharing that, buddy, said her husband. When I'd finished, everyone clapped. I gather you're an OBGYN, said Heidi.
No, just a father, recognizing that I have a valuable and fulfilling role to play in the pregnancy. She laughed.
You're an example to us all.
I hoped Rosie, sitting at the back, had taken notice. We covered a number of topics, most of which I was able to expand upon. I was conscious of Jack's advice, but I seemed to be the only knowledgeable person in the room other than Heidi. Everything seemed to be going very well. The topic moved to breastfeeding, where I had extended my research beyond the book.
It won't always be easy, and you fathers have to support your partner's choice to breastfeed, said Heidi.
Or not, I added, since the word choice implies an alternative.
I'm sure you'd agree, Don, that breastfeeding is always the preferred option.
Not always. There are numerous factors which may affect the decision. I recommend a spreadsheet.
But one huge factor is the immunity that breastfeeding gives to the child. We need a very strong reason to deny our child the best immune system.
Agreed, I said.
Let's move on then, said Heidi, but she had left out a critical fact. Maximum immunity is achieved by sharing babies among mothers. In the ancestral environment, mothers fed one another's children. I pointed to the street women. Madison and Delancey are best friends, living in the same house with babies due concurrently. Obviously, they should co-feed each other's babies in the interest of creating the best possible immune systems. I continued the argument with Rosie on the train home. In retrospect, it was probably more of what Rosie would call a rant than an actual argument due to all contributions being made by me. Chapped nipples are reported to cause agony, but mothers are expected to continue feeding to improve the immune system. Yet a social convention, a constructed social convention, with minimal underlying rationale, is enough to prevent a simple extension that...
Please, Don, just shut up, said Rosie.
Rosie apologized a few minutes later walking home from the subway.
Sorry I told you to shut up. I know it's who you are and there's nothing you can do about it, but you're just so embarrassing.
Dave predicted embarrassment. It's normal. But I was conscious that it was unlikely that anyone at Dave's class had been the catalyst for the public breakup of two best friends and their employment relationship, and an unstructured discussion involving most of the participants that violated the promise that the classes would be non-threatening.
Keep executing, Dave had said, to extend his baseball analogy. I was in imminent danger of being dropped from the roster. I needed help from the coach, my therapist.
I'm not your therapist, Don.
I intercepted Lydia as she left the clinic at the end of the day. I'd had no success securing an appointment and detected obstruction. She refused my offer of coffee and insisted on returning upstairs to her office. I'd come alone. I told her everything, excluding the Rosie Sonia substitution. More correctly, I planned to tell her everything but the description of the antenatal uproar, which I commenced with in response to her question, "What prompted you to come see me?" Occupied 39 minutes and was not finished when she interrupted. She was laughing. I could not have imagined Lydia laughing, but now she was laughing inappropriately at a situation that had driven my marriage to the brink of disaster.
Oh, God. Breastfeeding Nazis. Women whose maids are their best friends. You know what David Sedaris says? None of these women have someone else's maid as their best friend. It was an interesting observation, but not useful in solving my problem.
All right, said Lydia. We didn't get off to a very good start, you and I, and that's partly my issue. We do need people like you. You should know that I cleared you with the police after the first session. The only child you're a danger to is your own. I was shocked. I'm a danger to my own child.
I thought there was a risk. That's why I used the lever of the police report to see you again. I wanted to make sure you were safe. Report me if you like. But I was doing it for a good reason, and now you've come back voluntarily.
She looked at the clock.
Do you want a coffee?
I almost missed the social signal because it was so unexpected. She wanted to continue the conversation.
Yes, please.
She left me and returned with two coffees.
I'm officially finished for the day. I'm an hour past officially finished, but I want to tell you something. It might help to explain a few things.
Lydia sipped her coffee and I did likewise. It was of the quality I would expect from a university tea room. I continued drinking it anyway and Lydia proceeded with her explanation.
About a year ago, I lost a patient. She had postpartum psychosis. You know what that is.
Of course, one birth in 600, frequently no prior history. More common in prima gravidae, first births, I explained.
Thank you for your clarification, doctor, she said. Anyhow, I lost her and the baby. She killed the baby and committed suicide.
You failed to diagnose a psychosis.
I never saw it. The husband didn't report anything wrong. He was insensitive. So insensitive he didn't notice his wife was psychotic.
And you considered me capable of similar insensitivity.
I know you're trying to do the right thing, but I thought Rosie might be at risk of depression and you wouldn't pick it up.
Postnatal depression occurs in between 10% and 14% of births, but I'm adept at administering the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale.
She completed the questionnaire.
I asked her the questions.
Trust me, Dawn, you're not adept, but I've met Rosie. She's remarkably robust, probably a result of her early life in Italy. She's got your number. She obviously loves you. She's got purpose and structure through her medical studies. She's worked through her family issues. She's got a good network of friends.
It took me a moment to remember she was talking about Sonia.
What if she wasn't studying and didn't have friends and didn't love me? Surely even the support of an insensitive husband would be better than zero.
Lydia finished her coffee and stood up.
Luckily, that's not the position you're in. But paradoxically, having a husband like that is worse than having no support. He may well keep the woman from taking some positive action by herself. In my opinion, and there's research to support it, she'd be better off without him.
Chapter 29. I spent the next day at work, alone, attempting to deal with the problem generated by Lydia's observations. I undertook some supplementary research on the desirable attributes of a father. Non-violence was at the top of the list. My actions had led to arrest and referral to an anti-violence class. My meltdown was virtually indistinguishable from the outbreaks of anger that Jack the biker had discussed. I did not consider myself a threat to others, but I presume many violent people would make the same self-assessment. Drug use, slash lack of. My alcohol consumption, already at the highest daily limit I had been able to find, had risen significantly during the pregnancy. This was doubtless a response to stress. Jack the biker was right. It probably made me more vulnerable to meltdowns. Emotional stability, one word, meltdown. Sensitivity to child's needs, one word, empathy, my most serious weakness as a human being. Sensitivity to partner's emotional needs, see previous. Reflective functioning. As a scientist, probably good, but the fact that I'd been unable to find a solution to my relationship problem suggested I could not apply it to the domestic environment. Social supports. This was the only redeeming item in an otherwise disastrous list of shortcomings. My family was in Australia, but I was fortunate to have incredible support from Jean, Dave, George, Sonia, Claudia, and the Dean. And, of course, I had professional help from Lydia. Honesty was not included in the list, but was obviously a desirable attribute. I had hoped that when the playground incident was resolved, I could share it with Rosie. But it was an instance of weird behavior, and weird behavior was no longer acceptable. I created a spreadsheet, and it rapidly became obvious that the negatives outweighed the positives. As a potential father, I was manifestly unsuitable, and it was increasingly clear that I was no longer required in my role as a partner. Further research confirmed that it was not unusual for relationships to fail during pregnancy or shortly after the birth. The woman's attention naturally shifted to the baby at the expense of the partner. Alternatively, the male partner wanted to avoid the responsibility of fatherhood. The first had definitely occurred in our case, and while I was willing to take on the responsibilities of fatherhood, I had been rated as incapable by both a professional therapist and my wife, and now by my own self-assessment. My research provided some guidance on separation. Better results were achieved by swift and definite action rather than prolonged discussion. This was consistent with the portrayal of relationship termination in two films I'd watched during the Rosie Project, Casablanca and The Bridges of Madison County. In keeping with these films, I prepared a short speech of 9 pages outlining the situation and the inevitability of my conclusion. It was emotionally painful work, but the process of articulating the argument helped to clarify it in my mind. Jogging home with the speech prepared, I allowed my thoughts to wander. I had spent 16 months and 3 days married to Rosie. Falling in love with Rosie had been the single best event of my life. I had worked as hard as I could to maintain the situation, but, like Dave with Sonia, I had always suspected that there had been some sort of cosmic mistake that would be discovered and that I would be alone again. Now it had happened. It was, of course, not the fault of the cosmos, but of my own limitations. I'd simply got too many things wrong, and the damage had accumulated. I left work early to arrive home before Jean. Once again, Rosie was on the mattress. This time she was reading, but it was a formulaic romance novel of the kind my aunt read. I had made Rosie so unhappy that she was seeking relief in fantasy. I began my speech. "Rosie, it seems obvious that things are not going well with us. There is some fault," she interrupted. "Don't say any more. Don't talk about faults. I was the one who got pregnant without talking to you. I think I know what you're going to say. I've been thinking the same thing. I know how hard you've tried. But this relationship has always been about 2 independent people who had fun together, not about a conventional family. Why did you get pregnant then?" "I guess because having a baby is so important to me, and I had a fantasy that we could be parents together. I didn't think it through." Rosie said more, but my ability to process speech, especially speech about emotions, had been impaired by my own emotions. I realized I had hoped that Rosie would disagree with me, possibly even laugh at some error in my thinking, and things would return to normal. Finally, she said, "What are we going to do?" "You indicated you would return to Australia," I said. "Obviously, I will provide financial support for Bud as per convention. I mean, now. Can I stay here?" "Of course." I was not going to make Rosie homeless. She had no close friends in New York besides Judy Esler, and I did not want the Eslers to know about the separation yet. I still had an irrational hope that the problem would be resolved. "I'll stay with Dave and Sonia temporarily. It won't need to be long. I'll book a flight home before they won't let me fly." Rosie insisted it was too late to go to Dave's that evening, so I slept at the apartment. In the middle of the night, I woke to hear her performing her hot chocolate and bathroom ritual. Then the door opened. In the light from the living room, which was never completely dark, she looked interesting in an extremely positive way. Her shape had changed even further, and I was disappointed not to have been able to monitor it through closer contact. She was going to fly home. I would stay for a few days with Dave and Sonia and move back into the apartment alone. Perhaps I would also fly back to Australia at some stage. It made little difference. I'm not particularly interested in my physical surroundings. I liked the job at Columbia, with David Borenstein, Inga, the B-team, and, at least currently, Jean. Somewhere in the world I would have a child, but my role would be little different from that of a sperm donor. I would send money to assist Rosie with the costs and perhaps resume my cocktail-making job to supplement my income and social contact. Even in New York, I lived efficiently. My life would revert to the way it was prior to Rosie. It would be better for the changes Rosie had stimulated me to make and for the new ways I had of perceiving reality. It would be worse for knowing that it had once been even better. Without speaking, Rosie climbed into bed with me. She was moving differently with the additional weight of Bud and his or her support system, leaning back to take advantage of the 3rd wedge-shaped vertebra that human females have for that purpose. It seemed that she should ask permission, as it had never occurred to me to join her after she'd relocated to her study, but I was not going to object. She put one arm around me, and I wish I'd thought to freeze an emergency supply of blueberry muffins. To my surprise, the preliminary ritual was not necessary. In the morning, I slept past my automatic wake-up time. Rosie was still there. She would be late for her Saturday morning tutorial. "You don't have to go," she said. I passed the sentence. She was giving me an option.
but she was not suggesting she would change her plans to return to Australia, and she was not saying, I want you to stay. I packed a bag, and after taking an hour to create an accurate picture of Bud on tile 31, I took the subway to Dave's. When Sonia arrived home from visiting her parents, she wanted Dave to drive me back to my apartment, immediately. Dave had already helped me to move into his office, which was also the bedroom for their baby under construction, due to arrive in 10 days.
She's pregnant, said Sonia. We all have ups and downs, don't we, Dave?
She turned to me. You can't walk out on her just because you've had a fight. It's your job to make the relationship work. I checked Dave's expression. He looked surprised. Any psychologist, including Rosie, would surely agree that relationship success was a joint responsibility. We haven't had a fight. I've seen a therapist. It's clear I'm a negative influence on Rosie. She's going back to Australia. She'll have proper support.
You're the proper support.
I'm unsuited to fatherhood.
Dave, drive Don home. Help him sort this out.
It was 7:08 p.m. when we arrived at the apartment. Jean was home as his social life with Inga was over.
Where have you been?
He said. You're not answering your phone.
It's in my bag at Dave's. I'm now living with Dave. Where's Rosie?
I assume she was here. She's usually home before 1 p.m. on a Saturday. I explained the situation. Jean was in agreement with Sonia that we should attempt some sort of reconciliation. I've been trying to make the relationship work, I said. I think Rosie has too. The fault is intrinsic to my personality.
She's got your kid on board, Don. You can't walk away from that.
According to your theory, women seek the best genes from the biological father, but make a separate decision as to who they want to care for the child.
One thing at a time, Don. Like I said to Dave, it's the theory. Priority one is to find Rosie. She's probably off in some bar drowning her sorrows.
You think she'd drink alcohol?
Wouldn't you?
I'm not pregnant. If Jean was right, we had an emergency. Perhaps Rosie had left some clue in her study. I entered, and her computer was on. A Skype message was on the screen, from a person with the Skype name of 34, time zone Melbourne, Australia. I told you I'd be here for you. Stay strong. I love you.
I love you. I opened the application and looked at the preceding conversation.
Everything's turned to shit. It's over with me and Don.
Are you sure?
Are you sure you'll still have me? With a baby and everything?
Rosie walked in. She did not appear drunk.
Hello, Dave. What are you doing in my room, Don?
It was obvious what I was doing.
Is there some other man? I asked.
Since you ask, yes.
She turned away from Dave and me and looked out the window.
And he tells me he loves me.
I think I feel the same way about him. Sorry, but you asked.
Repeating patterns. Rosie's mother had slept with one man and married another who remained loyal to her despite them both believing Rosie was the original man's child. Rosie had deceived me, just as I had deceived Rosie. And for the same reason, no doubt, in order not to cause distress.
Dave drove me home to his apartment. He had heard the conversation. Neither of us could think of anything useful to say. Despite the plausibility, possibly the inevitability of what I just learned, I was stunned. I had no doubt who the other man was. Stefan, Rosie's conventionally attractive study partner, whom she acknowledged had been pursuing her in Melbourne before we became a couple. He had been 32 when I met him, and he could be 34 now. She had chosen him ahead of me to help with her statistics. Now she had chosen him to help her raise Bud. I considered him stupid enough to use an unstable string of characters as his identifier.
Chapter 30. Dave's office, which was now my bedroom, was a disaster. His desk was covered in paperwork. The stack of 7 filing trays was overflowing, and the cardboard boxes with dividers that he was using instead of a filing cabinet were in danger of tearing from internal pressure. It was obvious to me why his business was failing. Lectures were over for the year. My mouse data analysis was being performed competently by Inga, and I was not required by the Lesbian Mothers Project. It would have been a perfect opportunity for joint activities with Rosie. Instead, I had vast unscheduled time. I volunteered as a filing clerk.
Dave was desperate enough to entrust his business to a geneticist with an aversion to administration. And I was looking for anything to divert my brain from constructing mental images of Rosie and number 34.
Invoice copies go in this file, said Dave.
But you have them on the computer already. There's no need to print.
What if the computer blows up?
You revert to backup, obviously.
Backup? Said Dave.
It took only 2 days of focused work, omitting lunches, to fix the system.
Where are the files? Said Dave.
On the computer.
What about the paper files?
Destroyed. Dave looked surprised, in fact shocked. Correction, devastated.
Some of that stuff came from customers. Orders, authorities, sketches, it's all paper.
I indicated the scanner function of the device I had acquired for $89.99 and identified the remaining problem.
You're creating your invoices individually. Don't you have an application for that?
It's too hard to use.
I seldom find computer programs difficult to use, but I struck some problems with accounting rules due to not being an accountant. While Dave was at work, I enlisted professional help from Sonia, who had now ceased working in anticipation of the birth. She was unfamiliar with the software, but was able to answer all of my accounting questions.
I can't understand why Dave didn't ask me for help with this. He's always saying it's under control, but it obviously isn't.
I suspect that once he deceived you, in order to spare you stress, he found it increasingly difficult to admit to his deception over a long period.
Married couples shouldn't need to have secrets. I've told Dave that,
said the woman who had posed as an Italian medical student and told me not to tell Dave because he was a worrier.
Can you print an aged debtor's ledger for me?
Sonia asked when the system was configured and all data had been entered. I want to know how much we're owed. The report was available from the menu. $418.12 current.
What about the overdue?
$9,245 from 4 invoices, all issued more than 120 days ago.
Oh, God, she said. Oh, my God. No wonder he didn't want to buy a pram. If it's been 4 months, there's probably some problem with the work. Can you show me the invoices, the overdue ones?
Of course. Sonia looked at the screen for a few moments, then pointed to the phone on the newly acquired 4-in-1 utility.
Does this work?
Of course. Sonia spent 58 minutes on the phone employing a variety of tactics apparently tailored to create guilt, pity, fear, or, in one case, merely awareness. She was incredible. When she'd finished, I told her so. I spent half my life doing it to ordinary people who've overspent on trying to have a baby. Something I can relate to. After that, this is a breeze.
Are they going to pay?
The wine bar on West 19th is going to need to call to the owners. There's been a change of management since Dave did the work, and it sounds like the last guy left a mess. But the other 3 are okay, they just needed a little push.
Sonia raised the topic subtly at dinner.
I need some money to pay my credit card. Do you have anything?
Not right now, said Dave.
I'm just waiting for money to come through.
Everyone's slow, but the work's all good.
How much did you say we were owed?
Plenty, said Dave. Don't worry about it.
I am worried. If we need the money, maybe I can go back to work after the baby, part-time.
You don't need to do that. I just need to get the money in.
Tell me how much we're owed, and I'll decide.
Dave shrugged. You know me, I don't keep track exactly. 20,000, 30,000, we're good.
The next morning, Sonia was angry with Dave. Not at Dave, as he had gone to work early. She was directing her anger towards me.
He's out all day and half the night, and he's not earning any money. Is he actually working? Maybe he's going to the library, like these guys who lose their jobs and can't tell their wives. Is that what's going on, Don?
It was unlikely. Dave discussed his work with me in detail. He seemed to have plenty of it, but perhaps he was not charging enough or was lying about the client's satisfaction level. I'd been wrong about my friends before. I was still unsure if a central component of Jean's identity was a manufactured fiction. Claudia was in a relationship with Simon Lefevre, and Rosie was in love with another man.
If I have to go back to work, he can stay home and look after the baby. Maybe it'll force him to take an interest.
I retreated to Dave's office and worked on the problem. One possibility was that Dave had not entered all of the invoices into the computer. This had been the case, but I had rectified the problem. There had only been two small ones. When I thought more about it, it seemed odd that Dave was almost up to date in recording his invoices. A metaphorical light bulb went on. The obvious explanation